behold the works of Gabriel von Sanchez. His art was ambitious in its scope. His masterpiece was, of course, Dance of the Anarchists. Brilliant. Sanchez then began to play Ultima Exodus, the role-playing video game from FCI. It was a strange turn. Sanchez loved the game, and he spent less and less time in the studio. He was never the same. Consider Man with Dog.
Ultima Exodus for the Nintendo Entertainment System. Once you start playing, nothing else matters.
Welcome to 143 Pixels. I'm Bill, and we are here to talk about the games that we love. Each episode, I bring a friend, and that friend brings a game. This week, my friend is Scott Kurtz, and the game that he brought is Ultima 3 Exodus. Scott is a cartoonist and a podcaster. He makes a couple of fantastic webcomics. The first is PvP Online, which is like one of the longest-running webcomics that you will ever find. It's incredibly well-drawn, has some really great characters, and has been around for, like, since the 90s, I believe. It's pretty crazy how long this has been around. It started out as a bunch of people who work at a video game magazine, basically, and it's evolved since then. It's got some great characters, and he does it daily, which is absolutely bananas to me. He also has this really cool show called, or not show, but comic strip called Table Titans, which is about a group of D&D adventurers, basically. And that is actually a published graphic novel as well. And then he has a podcast called Surviving Creativity, which you can find wherever podcasts are downloaded. It's all about people who do creative things for a living and how they survive that. So make sure that you check all of that stuff. And at the end of the show, he'll give you all the URLs that you need in order to find that stuff. Let's talk about what he and I discussed on the show. This was an incredibly nostalgic episode. We talked about the history of video games a bit. We talked about the mechanics of Ultima 3 a little bit. We talked about turning single-player games into a multiplayer experience by sitting next to people as you play. We talked about books and maps that used to come with games and whether or not the disappearance of that is a bad thing or whether or not it should come back. We talked about sitting down with some graph paper and making a graph of the game as you play it, or a map of the game as you play it. We talked about all of these things from the jumping off point of Ultima 3, but to be honest, we really didn't talk about Ultima 3 all that much, but it was a wonderful conversation, and Scott was amazing as a guest, and I'm super happy that we get to talk about it. Now, I will say that even though we didn't talk about Ultima 3 a lot, we did totally spoil the end of the game. So I think it's pretty fair to say that, you know, people are not likely to play this game if they haven't already. But we do spoil the end of the game, and I just wanted to let you know. It was a really fun conversation, and Scott was an amazing guest, and I was very happy to have him on. With all that being said, let's go ahead and jump to the interview itself, where Scott and I talk about everything that we can under the sky, with the exception of Ultima 3 Exodus. Here to talk about that, and we can bring back to that at the end. We're here to talk about a video game that you love, and you could have picked any game in the world, and you picked Ultima 3 Exodus. How come?
Exodus. You know, I picked Exodus Ultima 3 because I am lucky enough to to be old enough to remember the beginnings of video games. I was alive before there were video games. And it was a crazy, fun time to be alive when video games hit the scene. Everything from just the excitement of seeing that first cabinet in like a pizza place, right? Like you've got an Asteroids machine behind you. I mean, I remember going to a Shakey's Pizza in West Des Moines, Iowa, and seeing that first Asteroids cabinet and the sounds and the brightness of the lines. And the same thing for Space Invaders, where they had that colored gel film over the to color it. Because it was only a white LED, but they put this like colored film transparency over the tube so that it would look like the Space Invaders were in color.
You know, I never thought about that, but that reminds me, when I was a kid, I played, it's either, I always forget this, it's either Intellivision or ColecoVision, and it came with transparencies that would stick to your TV.
Yeah, that was the Intellivision.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but I mean, and then the introduction of the home system, right? Like the Atari 2600, and then Atari broke into kind of the home computing things with the what was it? 800, the 400 and the 800 XL. Yeah. It was great, man.
What was your first home system?
You know, all of my friends had the 2600, that classic black Atari box. Our first home system was the computer, was the Atari 400. You have to understand that also back in the 80s, it was neighborhoods were a lot different. Kids were in everyone else's houses all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like you had, there was one neighborhood rule that every parent had, which was be home by the time the lights come on.
Yes.
And then no one knew where their fucking kids were, but they were always at someone else's house. So, you know, it was okay to not have the Atari because three of your friends had it. So everyone was over at someone's house. So my first introduction to the console was the Atari 2600. And my favorite game at the time was Yar's Revenge.
Oh, I love that one. I have it on the shelf behind me someplace. It's a great game.
It's still I'm sure there's a big nostalgia factor, but for me, it still holds up. But, and then we got the Atari 400 because my father really wanted a word processing program. And he knew Atari made computers with keyboards on them. And that we were excited because it could play games. So, we had the Atari 400 and then the 800 XL, both of which were still in my father's closet when we sold all the shit out of his house. Those early console games, we were hooked on all the games. There was just a big boom of these independent game companies, you know, taking advantage of this huge movement of home computing. It was this, and then the movie War Games came out, and then every news article and TV news did a story of, oh my God, these kids are in the arcade. They're playing video games. Now they're in front of TVs in their homes. Is this going to rot their brains? You know, no one's reading a book. They're all in front of these screens. And the sophistication of the game started to improve as more and more of these companies started making games and the computers got a little more powerful. We used to actually play video games by going down to the bookstore. We'd go to Walden Books in the mall, ride our bikes, and we would buy video games on the bookshelf. And it was a little baggie that had a little like printed pamphlet in it, like a stapled pamphlet.
Oh yeah.
And it was the basic code.
Mm-hmm.
And you would go home and you'd plug the basic cartridge into your computer and you would type in the code. You would transcribe from what was on the sheet into the computer. It would save it to cassette tape. And then that was the game.
Mm-hmm. I totally remember doing that too.
And yeah, and there was like Compute Magazine and stuff, and at the back was always a game. And so, like, I'm not saying that, like, we walked up the hill both ways in the snow. Like, we were learning code. Like, it was really exciting at the time. But anyway, I was always a big D&D fan. We all, that, you know, at the same time, D&D was a big deal. And here comes Richard Garriott with his Ultima series, where he was kind of bringing Dungeons & Dragons over into this whole computer gaming world. And we were just stoked about it. And then you get to Exodus, and it was the Exodus was like the third of the Ultima series, and it was the first one that I played all the way through. And it was a typical, you know, D&D style game set in the Ultima universe, where you're an avatar, you go out, you build a party, or you find people to join your party. It was a big open world. There was a map that you had to, with a fog of war that you had to reveal. You know, all things that now seem derivative, but this was the first time I'd ever seen any of this. It came with this printed cloth map. And my father took that map and mounted it on a piece of cardboard for us, and made with electrical tape and pins little red flags.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so, you know, he would come home from work, or we would be playing on the weekend, and we'd like, all right, let's go check out this corner of the map. And then we'd put on, you know, he would write, and he was a draftsman, so he had this perfect draftsman writing, and he would write, you know, on the flag maybe what we found there, and put it in the pin in the thing. And so the reason why I loved it was that it was the first game that was kind of open world. And, you know, the graphics, especially if you Google it, the graphics are very, very simplistic. It's stick figures. You mm-hmm. know, it's icons, essentially. It looks almost like a tactical map. But one of the things they did a really good job of doing was the instruction booklet had really, really beautiful illustrations in it. Little black and white spot illos that perfectly match the spot illustrations you would find in any Dungeons & Dragons book.
Oh, cool.
So, like, it was telling you, when you're in town, you can visit the clerics that will heal you, you can visit the merchant, you can visit the blacksmith, which all looked very simplistic in the game, but on the page describing this in the instruction manual were these awesome black and white, very graphic Dungeons and Dragons illustration of the blacksmith showing off his wares, which really sparked your imagination. And so as you're playing the game and you see the little icons in your brain, you're seeing that illustration. And they had one of all the different monsters, and they really did such a good job with that game of bridging the gap of, look, there's only so much we can do with the bits that we have mm-hmm. to represent a Gorgon or represent an ogre on screen. But we can have this amazing D&D artist draw that ogre in the instruction manual, and your brain will connect the two. And it just really was so immersive to us. And then, not to spoil it, because who's going to play it at this point? At the end, the bad guy, Exodus, was a computer.
Whoa.
And it was a fantasy story, but you were like putting punch cards into a computer to stop the devil. It was very much a pull the curtain back. It's not a demon. It's a computer. And we were like, whoa.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
It blew our minds.
See, the first Ultima game that I ever played was Ultima Online. I'd never played one before that. And so, like, I've had somebody on, and we talked about Ultima Online. I've had somebody on, and we've talked about Ultima 7, but I've never played any of those games. And so, like, that just blows my mind. It makes me wish that we would have another one, or not another one, because I know that, like, I think it's EA owns the series now, and Richard Garriott has nothing to do with it, and I don't really want EA to tackle it, but it would be awesome if they could get somebody to remake those games so that they would be played again, and so that people could be the Avatar and have their mind blown at this idea that the bad guy was a computer all along. That really is crazy. Go ahead.
No, Richard was kind of a visionary when it comes to that stuff. And I know that at some point he was working on something which was similar to the Avatar concept that was... You know, there are people that do that where they do spiritual successors to different games.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny how your experience in one game and one game property leads you to another. And and we did end up in Ultima Online. I could talk for hours about the adventures we spent in Ultima Online, but you know, the Ultima series led us to the Might and Magic series, and those and the Eye of the Beholder series, those kind of 3D dungeon crawl, take a step forward, map it out on graph paper on your desk as you go. And someone recently did kind of a spiritual successor to that, a series called The Legend of Grimrock, where it's the same kind of game. So I know what you're saying. It would be wonderful for someone to come up and say, let's do a spiritual successor to the Ultima series. You know, that, and I think a lot of it is, if you want to get that feel, there are a lot of JRPGs that feel that way. Because it was kind of a precursor to the JRPG game with the map, and then you find someone, an icon on a map, and that leads you to a separate screen with a battle that happens, and the fight back and forth, and the turn-based stuff. And also later on with the Gold Box SSI D&D games were kind of the same way. But there was just something about Exodus that I don't know. Again, it might just be nostalgia.
Well, hey, you know what? This show is all about nostalgia. It's about a game that you love.
It's hard to separate it.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. So when the game came out, like, had you already played the first two and you were like chomping at the bit to play the next one? Or did you just happen to find it on a shelf someplace? Probably not in a Walden's, but you find it on a shelf and picked it up and were like, oh my God.
You know, I think Ultima 3 was my first Ultima. And I know that I had friends that played, because then once you finish it, now you're stuck waiting for the next one, right?
Yeah.
And that's not available to you right away. So what you do is you say, well, there was an Ultima 2, maybe that would be fun. And even back then, you went back to 2 and went, this wasn't as good as 3. I don't really like playing it as much. But because it didn't feel the same. And they had made improvements in between. But I never did play 1 or 2, no. But I you know, I picked all the ones up after that. Ultima 4, and then, I'm trying to kind of look them up on the computer now as I talk to see if I can remember. Ultima 4 was Quest of the Avatar. It was a little bit more of the same, but we were just so excited to get it. And then it started branching off into, the graphics were getting better. Yeah, Ultima 5 was Warriors of Destiny. He did a bunch of them. At some point, it went 3D. I do remember that.
I think that was
7?
Well, I don't know about 7, but I think I remember when I was playing Ultima Online, and then I saw an ad for Ultima 8, and it was 3D. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't know how a computer can do this.
Yeah, Ultima 7 was isometric and felt very, very much like Ultima Online. Yeah, Ultima 9 was the 3D one, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the one that was 3D. And then there was the one that blew my mind, since we're talking about the Ultima series. Wasn't it called, Underworld? Did you ever play Ultima Underworld?
No, the only one that I played was Ultima Online. And I got hooked on MMOs, and like that's all I played for years was just MMOs.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we all did, right? That's one of the reasons why when you first contacted me, you're like, please don't say wow. Everyone says wow. And it's like, yeah. I mean, I've been playing that for 15 years. Yes. It's hard not to say wow.
I think I've had people pick World of Warcraft on the show, I think maybe 5 times.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. It's got a huge grip on a lot of people.
It absolutely does, and for good reason. I remember, and we can dip into it for a second, but I remember playing the beta of World of Warcraft, and it was the first time when I was playing a game that I felt like, okay, I feel like I'm lost in the woods. I was playing a dwarven rogue, and I was in the starting area, and I had gotten far enough from the little hut where you went to go turn in your quests, and I was like, I don't know where I am. And that felt so cool. And if I go back, I don't get that feeling anymore. And that makes me sad. But it's still an amazing game. I don't think I played anything but that for like 7 years.
Yeah, I mean, we had the same experience. And we came from UO, then to EverQuest.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, EverQuest 2 came out. And we were playing that and enjoying it a little bit. And then my wife said, you got to come in my room and see this, because she had her computer's in a different room, and she had just gotten in the beta, and she was in Ironforge, which now is old hat, and I can draw it in my head. I've been in Ironforge so much, but then it was all new. And EverQuest 2 was very much, it looked like Barbie dolls, like very smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And here was WoW, which was just miles of style, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't superb 3D stuff, but the design, the cartoony design of it was just a lot of really awesome style. And she gets on a griffin and flies from Ironforge to Stormwind, and we almost fell out of our chairs. We're like, oh my god, yeah, no, screw EverQuest 2. This is our game. But yeah, we were afraid to, we had started playing Horde, and we were afraid to go into contested areas. And I said, you know, I have an audience from my comic. I'm going to say I'm starting a guild, and if they're a fan of the strip, they should join our guild.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can have a group of people, and we can do these things. And within 2 or 3 days, we had a guild of 100-something people, and we're online with a whole group of people, and someone who now is a friend, his name's Jairo. He lived in Bogota, Colombia. And now I'm hanging out with him online. And he kept saying, I know where to go. I know how to get us through Ashenvale. And so we were just, like you said, lost in the woods. And I'm like, exec, you have no idea where you're going. He's like, have faith, Kurtz. Have faith. Have faith. I will get us there. Kurtz. He had no idea where he was going. And, you know, he just led us right into trouble. But yeah, you know, that is the spirit of, in my opinion, of those Ultima, early Ultima games, of that, you know, you first thing that happens when you open the box back then is you saw a bunch of floppy disks. But for the Ultima experience, one of the first things you saw was this beautiful cloth map, like at the beginning of a Tolkien book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like this promise of, this is what you're going to get to explore, you know?
Right, you could get lost. And,
yeah. And so, you know, I've been hooked on that promise since the 80s. So every time a game promises me that, just a map, an open world. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why people have, I mean, if you meet someone who's played Skyrim, you have met a person that has bought Skyrim at least 5 times.
Yes, absolutely. And they'll buy it 6.
Yeah. And if it comes out on another platform, they will buy it again.
Mm-hmm.
Because why not?
I played Skyrim and I never finished it, but I played it for a billion hours, I think, because I would just wander and get lost. And the story that the developers made for the game didn't really matter. It was my story as my character went through that world. And I suppose that's probably the story. Do you feel like the story of Ultima 3 is more important, or was it the story of little Scott Kurtz and you know, your siblings or whatever, or your dad, as you explored that map and put the pins on the wall?
That's the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it wasn't the overall arc of the story they wrote. It was the experience of exploring it. I mean, the best part of Ultima was doing something crazy in town and trying to game the computer, because a guard would appear and kill you instantly. And so could you get away with it? And the fact that they gave you the option to steal in town meant they wanted you to try.
Mm-hmm.
And just laughing and screaming and yelling at each other and, oh, God, why did you try it? And give me the keyboard. I'm going to do it this time. Like, that's the stuff you remember.
Absolutely.
Is they give you those opportunities, which is why Ultima Online was such a great game. It was the fucking frontier. It was the Wild West of those games. Like, you left town and someone could kill you and open your loot and just take all your stuff. So you never left town in your best armor unless you knew you could get you were going to risk it, or you could get somewhere safe, or you had your posse with you. Because if someone killed you, they would just open your corpse and take all your stuff.
Everything.
It was like, it was crazy.
Yeah, I remember
all the reagents for spells and
you would bury those in your bag, like three mm-hmm. bags deep or something,
yeah.
so that people couldn't steal them from you. I remember my friends and I were out in the woods. Like we had this little house right outside Trinzik. And so what would happen is people would go there because my buddy had a super good fletching skill. He could make really good bows or whatever. And
right.
so we would go into the woods and work together and chop down trees. And then he just loved it. He just loved sitting in the house, putting on some music and making bows and then putting them on the vendor and selling them so that we would have buckets of cash. And I remember once we were out there chopping down trees or something, and people like some PKs showed up and tried to kill us. And my friend had been macroing, a different friend. He had been macroing over like overnight, like every night, to get his
right.
pickpocket skill up really, really high. And like he walked up to him and he went into their inventory real quick and he pulled out all of their black pearl. And that was the reagent that you needed for all of your offensive
yeah.
spells. And so they weren't able to kill us. If you didn't have Black Pearl and you didn't have crossbow bolts, you were pretty much defenseless. And so we
yeah.
were able to take them out. But yeah, you're right. Ultima had that free for all. Was there, like, to get back to Ultima 3, was there like I know it's not an online game, but it was like, was it there like a free for all-ness to it? Like you said, you were stealing from the guards and the guards could like one shot kill you. Did you have any recourse against that?
I mean, no, if I recall correctly, like you saved your game so you could save your progress and try something crazy and then back up. I think there was that, the mm-hmm. save game state. But all that stuff that was in Ultima Online started there. So the Latin components to the spells and the reagents, all of that hardcore stuff was in those early games. Which was exciting when you played UO because it carried over. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't as sophisticated as a game, obviously, Exodus, Ultima 3, but it was, the thing about it was you would walk through the larger map and you could also build a boat and then you were out on the open ocean, which was terrifying because if you died on land, you could make your way back to your body. But if you died in the ocean, it was good luck. But you would, you know, every square you went forward, there was a chance that it would pop up and say you encountered somebody, or that someone would, you know, a bad guy would come beeline for you and aggro at you, and then you'd have to fight him. So there was that excitement of, okay, we're going to go to this area. Are we going to find out that it's way too crazy for us? We're not advanced enough. And I mean, there were so many intricacies to all of it, like picking the weapons and arming equipping each of your guys, and to think about all of that existing in a game in the 80s, on a game that came on floppy disk is nuts.
Right.
Nuts.
It sounds like, you keep saying we, it sounds like even though this is a single player game, it felt like a multiplayer adventure because you were sitting next to somebody the whole time. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, no, it was. We never played, I never really played by myself. It was always my brother and I, and sometimes my dad or a friend would come over, and you'd sit down and you'd decide where to go, and you'd take turns controlling it. And it was turn-based, right? So everyone, and you had a party of four. So when you were on the big map, it was one avatar. Mm-hmm. And then when you went into a fight, it put all four of you up. So everyone got a character, and everyone got to decide what their character did because it's turn-based.
That's awesome.
So it's, you know, so it's like, well, I'm going to be the archer. I mean, this translated directly from us playing D&D. So, you know, if my buddy was the archer and it was his turn to fight, he's like, shoot that guy with this bow, or I'm the wizard, so hit him with court pour. And, you know, we're all gathered around the computer, the monitor, you know.
Just tiny little monitor.
Yeah, the TV, the little TV.
That's awesome.
That we had on the desk, you know.
You talked a little bit about the graph paper and like making your own map as you went through a dungeon or whatever. Would you want to go back to a time where there isn't an auto-generated map and you got to sit there with graph paper, to the bane of math teachers everywhere? Like where you got this graph paper next to you and you have to make your own map in order to make the game? Or do you feel like, you know, we've come forward and it's better without the graph paper?
You know, that, not to bring up WoW again, but you know, that is a big argument even in the WoW community right now. And one of the things that we did, my buddy and I did recently, my business partner in crime that helps me produce my comics and stuff, is we did a live Twitch stream where we played through the old Eye of the Beholder series. And it's been ages since we've played them. It's been the 80s. And that is one of those things where you better graph where you're going or you're going to get lost. And it was a hell of a lot of fun the first three shows we streamed it. And then it was like, Jesus Christ, I'm looking this up. You know, I'm bored. So, I mean, yes and no. I definitely did it a little bit with the Legends of Grimrock. Just because it's an OG thing. And for me, because that's how I grew up playing those games. But, you know, that is an argument that's being held right now in the WoW community, especially with them bringing back WoW Classic and Burning Crusade Classic, is, was it better before? You know, was it better when it was harder, when it was a little more quote unquote hardcore?
Mm-hmm.
When you had to have a raid of 40 people to get through Molten Core, you know, when you had to draw stuff with graph paper or you were going to be lost. And it's interesting because I'm in a different place in my life now. So I'm not, I'm not 15, I'm 50, you know? And so a lot of these games are designed now around quality of life choices, and even older games like WoW, where they've introduced quality of life choices where you can solo a lot, you can do looking for group, you can do, you know, they have flex dungeons that if you only have 10 people, it'll adjust.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go in with 10. Well, you only got 9 this time. Okay, well, it'll adjust. And some people feel like a bit of the game is lost in that, and it's not as easy, and some people appreciate it because they don't have the time to dedicate to playing that they used to. So I think every once in a while, it would be nice to have a game where you had to go back and do that stuff. But I don't know how well it would sell or how well it would do for the company that had to invest all that time in making that game. It seems like a subset of a subset of a subset of people that would want to play that. But, yeah, there's a part of me that misses it.
I get exactly what you're saying. I was, I had David Brevik was on the show, and we were talking about EverQuest. That was like his favorite game. And, it was funny because we were talking about, you know, when you die, you lost experience, and then you were naked and you had to go find your corpse, and, it's surrounded by orcs and it was hard. And if you were a barbarian, then you couldn't friggin' see anything because you couldn't see at night. And we were talking about this and we kept saying how amazing it was. And all I couldn't think of is, to anybody who has zero nostalgia for EverQuest, they would have said, why in God's name would you ever want that? There was no map in the game. Like, you had to type / Loke in there, or sense heading in order to see where things were.
There was no instancing in the game.
Yeah.
There was one world boss. There was one dungeon. One. And if one guild was in it, you couldn't be in it. You had to sit and wait your turn. Mm-hmm. My wife refused to go to a Sting concert in real life because she got the call that it was their guild's turn to attack this one dragon in EverQuest.
Was it Nefarian or Vox?
I don't remember. I was so pissed at her. I called my brother and I'm like, "You want to go see Sting?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Great, because my wife won't leave EverQuest."
Oh my God, that is hilarious. There's something to be said for the old ways, but there's definitely something to be said for the new ways as well. You know, speaking
it's also a badge of honor, right? It's also a badge of honor.
I think so. Played this game back when you didn't have a map.
It's like when you meet someone at a record store that's like, "I fought the punk wars for you little shits." It's like, I camped Vox for 6 days so my guild could get one piece of gear, and it would end up being for the goddamn bard.
Uh-huh. Oh my God.
You didn't even know how to weave 5 songs.
Right. Remember when you had to, like, you had all these people in the guild and you had to do the pre-buffs?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you got your buff, log off, and then wait for ICQ to get a message so that you know to log back in.
Yep.
All that stuff was terrible. But speaking of, like, the old ways, you know, you were talking earlier about, you know, the map and the book having all this stuff. And now these days, games don't come with any of that.
None of it.
And I feel like it is a shame, and I don't think it'll ever happen again. What are your thoughts on that? Is it necessary?
Not for the way games are produced now. And I do think it's a shame, because there's benefits to the way games are produced now. But it also pisses me the hell off. And I don't know if it's just because I've gotten old and I'm screaming at kids on my lawn, metaphorically. But if I can go to Best Buy, which no one even does anymore, but if I could go to Best Buy and buy a game on a shelf and spend money for it, you don't get to tell me that game is early access.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't then get to... Like, if you went to the trouble of printing it on physical media and putting it in a box and distributing it to a Best Buy, that is not an early access game. So it's great, because much like the industry I come from, which is comics, the traditional way of producing and distributing that content used to be through physical media. There was a scarcity to it, and there were gatekeepers to get it to a large audience. Mm-hmm. It had to go through a syndicate. It had to go through a publisher. Games were the same way. You had to be in a big studio or a big publisher. It had to be distributed to stores. People bought it on physical media, brought it home to their computers. Well, now anyone that wants to make a game can start a little indie game developer, make a game, and put it on Steam, which is great for us because we get to play all these amazing games. But there's just not going to be any kind of an economy or a budget for, or a need even for, producing any kind of the physical media that accompanies it.
Right.
And people don't consume information that way anymore either. So, you know, it used to be that you could buy, not only would the game come with a manual, but then you could go buy the strategy guide,
mm-hmm,
in the bookstore.
Yeah.
You know, there was a whole separate company that would write an even more detailed instruction manual. Well, now it's all online, right? And it's not even really professional writers and editors doing it. It's, you know, you go on YouTube and it's like, "Hey, it's your boy Ghost Snot. Smash that like and subscribe button.
Ghost Snot.
You know, hey, don't forget I got Ghost Snot merch." And you're like, "Please, can we just get..." Anyway, so here's how you get the thing. You go to the deal and you go in the cave and there's the fucking thing. And then you're like, "Okay, thank you." You know, and then the people that make the games, they don't have to worry about that stuff. They don't have to worry about strategy guides. And even if they did, no one would buy them, because you can just Google it and get a walkthrough. So, yeah, I mean, there's a part of me that thinks that it stinks. There's part of me that thinks that it wouldn't work anyway, and that just the way games are made now and the types of games. Like, for example, the biggest game manual I've ever seen in my life is for Falcon, the game Falcon, which was a flight simulator.
Oh, okay.
It was like an F-15 flight simulator. And I had one friend that was super into it. And it literally came with a flight instruction manual. I think at the end of it, you'd have a license. I'm sure now they wouldn't print it because for fear a terrorist would get a hold of it.
Yeah.
But it was like he would get in the plane, do all the pre-flight stuff, take off, put on autopilot because he was on a mission to go, you know, bomb something or be in a dogfight. And I'm like, now what? And he's like, well, now we're flying to Kuwait, so we go make a sandwich. Because it was like it was a simulator. It wasn't truncated into some kind of fictional experience. It was like trying to simulate what it's really like. And I'm like, God, this game is boring. But that manual, it was a binder, like a ringed binder.
Probably cost more to manufacture the binder than it did the game itself.
Absolutely it did. Microsoft Flight Simulator had a really big manual. But I don't know. Do you miss it? Do you miss that stuff?
Well, I mean, you look behind me. I have a bunch of nostalgic stuff. I do have
I got it too. I have all the collector's edition of WoW up here on the shelf, but
yeah,
you know.
It's tough because that stuff, like, it was always, there's a nostalgia for, okay, so I remember when I was a kid and I would go to the store and I would buy a game or whatever, and my, you know, my parents are driving back to the house or something, you would open up the game and you would read through the manual on the way. And then as I got older, a lot of the times I would buy the game, I would put the game in, and then I would just toss the manual off to the side. And if I needed to look it up, then I would grab it and look it up. But most of the time I was like, I can figure this out. And I would ignore the manual. But for some reason, I still liked it being there like a security blanket because it's cool. Like,
yeah,
I love looking at this stuff. Like when you were talking about with Ultima 3, all of those illustrations and stuff, you know, flipping through. I remember recently I was playing through the original Zelda and I was like, oh, okay, what was the, I don't remember what this character is called, this enemy. And so I would grab the manual. Or I would look it up. I would look up the manual online, like a PDF, and be like, oh, okay, that's the, oh my God, those are the Lynels that I've been fighting in Breath of the Wild? I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I hadn't played Zelda in so long. That's amazing. And now I totally see it. Whereas I didn't really see it until I looked in the manual. And so I do think that there's something missing, but you're absolutely right. There's zero
market
for it.
Do you remember when copy protection used to be little gadgets that would come on the box? Like,
yeah,
some Da Vinci Code turn the spinner dial. Wheel or they had the red film that you'd put over the like the QR code that would give you the numbers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Or it would be like on page 3, paragraph 7. What's the third word?
What's the third word?
Yeah.
The manual. Yeah.
I love that. I also really love the. This is completely unrelated, but the age verification of games like Leisure Suit Larry, it'd be like, who was the president in this year or whatever? And so you're sitting there and you're like, Mom, who was the president of such, you know, it's, and they're who was the vice president for Ford? And so then she would tell me and I'd type it in and I could play the game.
Yeah, that's how I learned who Spiro Agnew was.
That's right.
Leisure Suit Larry.
God, man, my Leisure kid Suit really Larry. Loves politics. That's so weird.
I'm so proud of him.
You talk about...
Meanwhile, we're trying to catch the glimpse of an 8-bit side boob.
8-bit side boob is the name of my high school cover band.
There you go.
There you go. You mentioned the illustrations and stuff in the books. Did that inspire you to be a cartoonist? Or was it more... like the Saturday morning or Sunday morning cartoon stuff, or was it the D&D books? What do you think was, did the video games bring you there, or were you already there?
I think it all contributed. My big push to be a cartoonist was my mom bought me the first Garfield collection.
Oh, I love.
Because at the beginning of that, I mean, I was always kind of obsessed with the aesthetic of cartooning. I love drawing cartoon characters And I think that up until the first Garfield collection, my inclination was to create characters. I watched a lot of cartoons, so I didn't write stories or do sequentials. I just came up with character ideas. So it was almost like if now you were to pick up someone pitching a show to Cartoon Network, and it would be like the Bible of the show, and it would be one of the character description sheets. Mm-hmm. We did that a lot. And then in the very first, the very, very first Garfield strip starts with John saying, "Hi, my name is John, and I'm a cartoonist. This is my cat Garfield." That's the very first panel, the first Garfield strip. And that was the first time I had heard the word cartoonist. There was a job, like my dad had a job, mm-hmm. where you made comic strips that went in the newspaper. And I became obsessed with how to become a cartoonist. So that really led me down the path. But everything contributed. Dungeons & Dragons was a huge, huge, huge part of me becoming a storyteller. And definitely video games contributed to that. I mean, I was obsessed with pretty much all graphic art. So one of the great, great things about video games in the 80s was because the graphics were so simplistic, to sell a game, you had bitchin' cabinet art. You had great cover art. And, you know, those companies didn't slouch when it came to that. And I was obsessed with comics too, and I was flipping out when I know that the cabinet art for Ikari Warriors was like drawn by one of the comic book creators whose books I followed from Marvel Comics, and I was like, I know this artist, he draws Alien Legion for Epic Comics. And you know, that was the shit back in the day, man, was just being obsessed with that kind of iconic graphic representation that you didn't get in the games themselves. And then when it started happening in the games, you know, that was even crazier. And I remember all of us getting on our bikes and booking it to the mall because we had heard about the game Dragon's Lair.
Oh my God.
Which, you know, like, I mean, that just blew our minds. Like, oh my God, how did they even do this? And so, I mean, I remember talking to the guy that ran the arcade, and he was like, there's a disc in here, and it just plays the movie, and it just, like, the computer just decides what next scene to play, and we didn't care. We just thought it was the coolest thing ever.
I watched, like,
to have that kind of graphic.
What's that?
To have that kind of interaction in a video game look that good was unheard of.
Oh, absolutely. Damn it, I wish I could remember the name of the YouTube channel. There's this YouTube channel that does, like, the history of, like, G.I. Joe and the history of this. It's like Toy Universe or Toy Galaxy. I think it's Toy Galaxy.
I think I know. It's a guy that's like, here's the history of Thundercats.
Yes, exactly. And I watched the one that was the history of Dragon's Lair, and it was really, really good. So if you haven't watched it, you should definitely check it out.
I will.
Did you find yourself like playing Ultima 3 and then like, all right, so I just did this cool thing. I killed an ogre in a cave or something. Did you find yourself drawing that encounter and being like, look at this. This is what happened in the game. This was my story.
Yeah, we did that all the time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We would draw our characters and stuff from the game. Absolutely.
Did you, like, in that game, do you, like, name your characters and stuff?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Did you name it Scott, or did you come up with your own
character? No, we came up with characters.
Okay.
But we were doing that for D&D, too, so.
Was it just your D&D characters?
I couldn't even tell you. I don't even remember. So, my dad was really good at naming that stuff, too, so everyone got their chance to contribute and name stuff.
That's awesome. Did you play the game multiple times? Like, did you beat it and then go back and play it some more another day? Or is it just the once?
I wish I could tell you I even remember. We might have. There was a lot of games coming out, so I can see us never returning to it. But we did love the hell out of that game. I think we went back and played it more than once. I absolutely do think we went back and played it more than once.
What's your strongest memory from that game?
It's the room that we played it in West Des Moines. downstairs. My father had built an addition to our home, and that kind of became our playroom. And the computer stuff was set up in there. It was a really cozy kind of little place. And it was just that one corner with the computer on it and all the stuff up on the wall and computer magazines everywhere. I don't know. It's very bittersweet now because, you know, my mom's gone and my dad is in, you know, diminished a little bit due to some strokes that he had. And you know, I just turned 50. And so there's a lot of reflecting on a different time in my life when it was just the four of us, just me and my brother, my mom and my dad, you know, and you get wistful and you think about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for me to separate that game from that time and that experience. But like, I remember New Coke, the New Coke.
What a mistake.
What a mistake. But I remember the discussion about New Coke and us arguing with my friend Charlie Hutzler about whether New Coke was better than Old Coke as we were playing that game, you know, as well as others. But like, it's impossible for me to separate that from that time in my life. So, I mean, that's the best part of it. Mm-hmm. It's just that it was all so new and that it was all so exciting. No one had ever experienced that stuff before. No one had ever gotten to do that stuff before. And every time a new game came out, there was something new to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I even remember how excited we all were for Zork, which was a text adventure.
Right.
And then we got to, but I think what's different now, and the thing that I lament the most, even more than manuals, was we didn't just play Zork. We got excited, and then we tried to program our own text-based game. And, you know, I see that happening a lot now in other media, and maybe I'm just not paying attention to what the kids are doing, and they are writing their own games. But, yeah, it was just an exciting time.
Absolutely. It feels like if you know, you were talking about how there was always something new and everything felt fresh as the video games were coming out and new genres were being invented. And today it feels like if you didn't live through that time of gaming, you really are missing out on something. It's something that almost has come and gone and it's never coming back.
No, it's not. It's not. No one's going to ever. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers and you hear about both Steve Jobs and Bill Gates's first exposure to personal computing and having that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you look at my history with webcomics, there's never going to be another time again where webcomics are happening for the first time. People are posting comic strips and comic book stuff online and skipping publishing. And gatekeepers like that. That's never going to happen again. So, yeah, it was just, you know, it's just a cool thing to have been able to experience. My dad is a German immigrant, and he came to America when he was 13. And so he was already somewhat, not grown, but, you know, I ask him all the time, like, yeah, you were there when, like, the Beatles happened and the Rolling Stones and the moon landing. Like, you were there for all of that. Like, what was that like when the Beatles hit? And he's like, I didn't listen to the Beatles. And I didn't care about the Rolling Stones.
That's
because
so disappointing.
he was from a different culture. He didn't care about sports, really, until he met my mother, because he was German. They cared about soccer. Like, we always give him such a hard time, like, all this shit was happening around you. You didn't even notice it. How can you not have been there for the Beatles? He's like, you know. My father into easy listening and German music. But, yeah, I mean, we got to experience that. We got to experience that. There's other things, like, I remember making prank phone calls. you know, just dumb stuff.
Oh, like, yeah.
You can't make a prank phone call now.
No. Oh, my God. When they invented caller ID, it was the end times.
Yeah.
That phone call, the phone would ring back and you'd be like, oh, no.
Yeah. Those, what's funny is like, that to me is like my proto podcasting days, because my buddy Rob and I, who I've known since the fifth grade, we would come up with skits. We were just calling people and saying, like, is your refrigerator running? We would call random numbers and pretend that lines had gotten crossed and that we were on a phone conversation, and somehow their line got caught into it. We would start yelling at them, how did you get on this line? And they're like, I don't know. And they were like, this is the craziest thing that's ever happened to me. And then we'd be like, well, what's your name? Well, I'm down here on 32nd Street. Like, we had whole bits, and we would record it on cassette tape with our boom boxes. Like, we were producing radio shows, prank calling people. You just can't do that anymore. So yeah, not that even comes close to answering your question, but that's my favorite thing about Exodus. It's just the time that it existed in, and the fact that it was like the first big open world thing that I ever got to play.
I feel like that answers the question better than anything about the game could have. So okay. I think that's fantastic, Scott.
Well, to bring it full circle, I was able to comment one time about these games, and Richard Garriott actually responded to me and said he had read PvP, and that blew my mind.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so full circle. Lord British, the guy that created those games, I grew up and he saw my work and liked it. So that's pretty cool.
Well, let's talk about your work real quick. Tell people where they can find all things Scott Kurtz.
Well, if you want to see the cartooning stuff that I do, you can go to pvponline.com. You can read my daily comic strip, PvP. I've been doing it since 1998. I also have written some graphic novels about a group of friends that played Dungeons & Dragons called Table Titans. You can find that on Amazon or at your comic book shop, but you can also read it for free online at tabletitans.com. And I do a weekly podcast that I really want you to listen to called Surviving Creativity, where I talk to people that I've met over my 23-year career about how they make a living doing creative things and survive the experience. So listen to it. If you like it, please tell a friend about it. Please do share the podcast and share this podcast too with a friend. First, share this podcast with a friend.
Share a podcast with somebody.
Share a podcast, for God's sakes.
Why are you so selfish, keeping all of these podcasts to yourself?
Listener, you, right now, with those headphones in your ears, you're on your damn phone all day. Look at those texts. Can't one of them be to share a podcast? For God's sakes.
It's the least you can do.
The unmitigated gall of you not having shared a podcast today. But yeah, check out Surviving Creativity. I'm proud of it.
What's the URL for that?
It is survivingshow.simplecast.com.
All right.
But you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, all of them.
All of them. Well, Scott, it was awesome talking to you. I really appreciate
it. It was really good talking to you too, man.
It was fun. Each episode, I ask my guest to close out the show with our little motto, which is the resolution doesn't matter.
The resolution doesn't matter.